welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 205 of the podcast, and this will go out the week before Christmas, but I'm recording this intro in advance as I'm in New Zealand for December. And in fact, if you're listening to this on the day it goes out, I should be scuba diving at the Poor Knights Islands in Northland, where I used to dive a lot when I lived out there in the early 2000s. So I'm really looking forward to going back, and yeah, it should be fun. It's temperate. That's the kind of waters. But there's in the summer, there's really just fascinating kind of creatures there. I've seen, you know, and there's dolphins and whales, and it's very cool. So anyway, I'm really excited about that. Today is actually the last podcast for 2014. So this is a roundup for the year. And oh, I should say happy holidays. Happy holiday season, whatever your brand of holiday. So this is a roundup, a discussion with Hugh Maguire from pressbooks.com, who has been working in the publishing space for years now. And if you listen to Mitch Joel's Twist Image podcast, you'll have heard him there on Media Hacks, which I used to listen to when they did it more often. We talk about some of the biggest stories of 2014 and how that affects indie authors. And as ever, I am happily positive, and he brings a slightly more muted response. But probably I need that sometimes. But it does remind me there are a lot of podcasts out there these days, and it seems to be incredibly trendy to start a podcast. So I know you have listening choices, and I just wanted to thank you so much for listening to my show, which started actually in March 2009, before podcasting was trendy and before self-publishing was trendy as well. So yeah, as ever, I like being ahead of the curve, and thank you for listening. Thank you for sticking with me. So just as a sort of roundup for me, I've been doing my own goals. I like, you know, blogging and podcasting is great because it keeps me accountable. If I have nothing to report to you, you know, I'm meant to be a professional author, and if I have nothing to report to you, then clearly I'm not doing my job. And I always post my goals on the 1st of January and round them out by 30th of December. So I've just written the blog posts rounding up whether I've met my goals. My main aim was to write more books. And I've put out 4 this year, which is high by some standards and incredibly low by other people's standards. And remember, we have no comparisonitis in this community. We're all happily supportive and wonderful, but you know, I suffer from the green-eyed monster as much as anyone. But I did do public speaking for authors, creatives and other introverts, as well as business for authors, which kind of round out my non-fiction pack for authors. I also updated the second edition of How to Market a Book. So that is kind of, well, it's not new, but it's updated, got some new stuff in. I also did Delirium, London Psychic Book 2, my British detective meets psychic researcher murder mystery, and also Day of the Vikings, which is just a romp, really, lots of fun. And you can actually get Day of the Vikings for free if you go to jfpenn.com/freebook. I'm offering it there for free at the moment, so check that out, jfpenn.com/freebook. Gates of Hell is also done and on pre-order, but I decided to publish it in January because of the manic holiday season, so I'm not counting that in my year's sort of number, but you can pre-order that on all the ebook stores, coming in print and audio in early 2015. Some highlights, I guess, for the year included hitting the New York Times and USA Today list with the Deadly Dozen back in March, which was one of those kind of exciting things. And in fact, 2014 really has been the year of the box set, I think we call it that. And of course, now lots of these lists have changed the rules, so it's very difficult to hit with a box set. But there you go. I moved into audio as ACX.com launched in the UK, which is, you know, brilliant. And that's added to the old income streams, which is fantastic. And I will be doing a lot more audio in 2015. I'm actually going to be recording my own nonfiction and putting that on Audible as well. And I may also be doing collaborative stuff. So watch out for that later next year. I've learned about being a better writer, focusing on the craft. A couple of highlights there, the Thriller Fest Masterclass with David Morrell in New York City, as well as Robert McKee's Story Conference, which was amazing. And also, I think probably a big thing that's made a difference for my writing and my sort of professionalism is finding my editor, Jen Blood, who is absolutely the right fit for me. I've also gone into more languages with two books in German, one in Spanish, one in Italian. So it's been a big year for translation as well. And if you look at this with a kind of product business head, I have four new books in 2014. But with all of those extra audio translation, etc., I produced 19 new products and income streams. So that's quite exciting. All trickles, but you never know. I've also spoken in New York, Toronto, Stockholm, Frankfurt, London, and we'll round the year out in Auckland, New Zealand, where I'm doing a little talk. And I've continued to blog and podcast, removing guest posts in April and focusing on being a graduate level education for indies. So I hope you're still finding the website and the podcast useful and the YouTube channel and all that. So it's been a good year and I'm ready for a lot more in 2015. In fact, I can't wait to get started. I'm one of those people who doesn't really like the end of the year and is far more interested in new beginnings. And, you know, I like New Year. So Christmas in New Zealand is warm and kind of sunny and nice, so it's not really the same as being in London. But I hope you're excited about the outlook for next year as well. There will be lots more ups and downs, but if you concentrate on writing, pleasing your readers, I believe it's happy times ahead and we will adjust together to the changing market. Okay, so this podcast is sponsored, this episode of the podcast, in fact, is sponsored by 99 Designs, where you can get amazing book cover design, as well as logos, web pages, business cards, t-shirts, banner ads, and custom illustrations. And we all know that professional design for book covers is one of the best marketing tools for your book. And you can get a design that you love with dozens of designers and 100% money back guarantee, as you only pay if you're happy with one of the designs submitted. So go to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A, to get a $99 power pack of services for free. So that's 99designs.com/Joanna. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing this show is primarily sponsored by you guys. A big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, and a shout out to new sponsor, William McCausland of MutantEpoch.com, which looks awesome. I will be a bit behind in announcing people because of recording in advance. So if I haven't read out your name, I will be doing that in January. So thank you so much for sponsoring. And if you don't know, Patreon is like a kind of ongoing Kickstarter, and you pay per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month. So even giving just $1 a show means it's less than a coffee a month. So thank you. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much and happy holidays. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Hugh McGuire. Hi Hugh.
Hello, Joanna. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you on the show. So just a bit of an introduction. Hugh is an author, professional speaker and publishing expert, founder of Pressbooks, an online book publishing platform built on WordPress, and also LibriVox.org, the largest library of free public domain audiobooks in the world, and a whole load of other things. And Hugh, it's pretty impossible to sum you up, and I think the word creator may be it. So maybe just give us a bit more info, a bit background on you.
LibriVox was really the first sort of publishing project beyond just little bloggy things that I had done. And so really since then, that was back in 2005, I've been working on, bringing the world of literature and literary life into the modern era on the web and trying to find different ways to do that. So again, there was LibriVox is kind of the main, was the first big project I did doing that. I also have a spin-off from LibriVox, which is Iambic Audiobook, which was trying to look at different models for creating audiobooks. And then what I spend most of my time on these days is Pressbooks, which again is an online book creation tool. So I don't quite know what my official universal title ought to be, but it's somewhere between thinking, a thinker about the future of books, but trying to create tools and communities and different things that help move us towards that future.
Mm. And you're in Canada, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
so in Montreal.
For the video, I'll just point out I have a glass of wine because it's 6:30, but it's only lunchtime where you are.
I have some water. So.
There we go. Fantastic. So this is actually our 2014 kind of annual roundup show, and it's great to have you along because you do so much. And I actually do want to start with audio because I know ACX, which is Amazon's Audible thing, is not available to Canadians as yet, but it did open up in the UK this year. Mm-hmm. And for many authors, for many indie authors, has become a massive kind of stream. So I wondered if you would talk a bit about audio. Like, obviously you believe in audio, you've got two audio platforms, as you said. You know, what do you think about what's going on in the audio right now?
So my understanding is it's growing at a very good clip, which is great. I think audio is a very funny market. So the really in the digital world, there's one player and one player only, and that's Audible, which is owned by Amazon. And they really control something like 90% of the market. So they're really the only player of consequence. They have a deal with iTunes. So if you want to be in audio, then you have to go through Audible that gets you into iTunes as well. It's kind of a funny market. I think it's probably similar to the ebook market in that it's really the genres that do well. So in particular, romance is a huge category there. And at Iambic, which was kind of an experiment, our successes were really around sci-fi, romance, and even less mystery seemed to be less big, but it was really sci-fi and romance were the two big categories that worked. I think that the problem with the audio market is that a typical breakdown, and I haven't seen the latest numbers, but the typical breakdown is you might get a 10% additional sales in audio compared to what you're doing in ebook. So I think that's a way to look at whether it's worth investing your energies into it or not. But it is a niche market on what is, at least in some categories, a niche market. You know, ebooks are still 20% in some categories. Probably romance, I think it's closer to 50 now. But it is a smaller niche market, but if you're doing a certain amount of sales, then audio can become very important. And it's like with everything in content businesses right now, and particularly ebooks, that there's just a growing supply of content, and so being good at marketing content becomes really the most difficult and important thing. So, if you're seeing demand in your readers for audio, then that's a good chance that that there's going to be demand out there, but you have to sort of look at the numbers and see what kind of investment it's worth making for you as a business.
Yeah, and I mean, my feeling with audio as well is, you know, we talk about marketing there, and it's almost at this where we are now, it's the discoverability word, which of course is a nice publishing-y word, but you know, in audiobooks, there's very few audiobooks compared to ebooks. So even though you mentioned there it is, you know, you can do a sort of 20% sales or whatever, you still can stand out more right now in audio. And most traditionally published books don't have an audio book associated.
Right, particularly smaller books, because in the normal way that professional audiobooks are produced is quite expensive. Mm-hmm. So ACX provides a new kind of model that was very similar to what we had envisioned with Iambic, but it's sort of a rev share kind of model across the board. And so that's a smart way to go about doing it. I think, you know, if you're looking at publishing as a self-publishing as a business, or small independent publishing as a business, which anyone who's doing it ought to be at least considering whether it is or not, I think it's really important to look at the holistic picture. So having audio, having print in addition to ebooks, to me is part of sort of marketing a package of yourself or your publishing business as just that, a publishing business. And I think, as you say, it's a way to stand out. It's a way to show the reader how professionally you're taking your creative enterprise. And I think that goes a long way to, I think, you know, because there is so much content, people want to see if I'm going to spend some money on a book. You know, it sort of helps them make the decision, I think, if they see that someone's been putting the effort into these other kinds of channels. Whether or not those channels become specifically profitable or not, I think you have to look at your overall picture as a publisher.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a roundabout way to say that, you know, like with everything, there's no gold rush anywhere. It's you know, you have to work at every sale you make in every channel, but the more channels you're in and the more formats you're in, the more likelihood you have of building up your long-term goals as a publisher.
Absolutely, and of course everybody listening to my show has a business as an indie author.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's
I laugh because I try and encourage that, but I realize that a lot of people don't.
Well, you know, it's perfectly fine to have a writing career that isn't a business, but then don't complain when you don't make any money at it. If you want it to be something that gives you money, then you've got to take on the business side of it. Again, whether you're and that's true whether you're self-publishing or publishing with a big publishing house. I mean, you know, everyone has to be hustling out there in this world of abundant content.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we'll come back to that. But another big development this year has been Kindle Unlimited and, I guess, subscription models. And I wondered if, and also the exclusivity issue. Let's start with exclusivity in publishing platform. Obviously, you're with Pressbooks. This podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. So we're no fan of exclusivity here. But obviously, new authors do find it useful. I do use it for my foreign translations because I have no other way really of marketing. What's your opinion of exclusivity and the future of that?
Yeah, I think so. I guess morally, I think, and sort of in a wider system point of view, I think it's not great for anything in the long term. In the short term, it's a business decision that can make a lot of sense. You know, I don't know what the numbers are across the board these days, but Amazon continues to dominate the ebook market. I think that you're seeing places, you know, Kobo, for instance, has been very active in growing international markets, so that becomes a very interesting platform. Apple as well is starting to grow. You know, they've got the devices in people's pockets that people are reading on. So I think that, you know, I think using targeted exclusivity is not a bad idea. I think there are dangers associated with the long term. So I think that, you know, you can use it for certain titles and it be effective. And you know, again, if you're seeing, you know, 80% of your sales coming through the Amazon channel and you can get more favorable terms if you go exclusive with them, then it's not a crazy way to go about things. So I think that the danger is just that then you're locked into a single platform that is going to dictate terms as time goes on, and you become more and more dependent on one platform, and that becomes a dangerous business proposition, again, if we're looking at a long term of 10 years. Mm. So that's the exclusivity side of things. And then the Kindle Unlimited, I think all these subscription models, you know, they're not going to make it easier for people to make money on individual sales. So it's going to change the nature, the financial dynamics of the business. But what all of us are fighting against from a commercial point of view is just overabundance of supply of content. You know, anyone can publish now. And so that means there's a lot of stuff out there. And so, you know, people, the amount people are spending on books isn't going to grow indefinitely, and we have to find new ways to just grow the amount people are reading, and subscriptions are a great way to do that.
Hmm. And then, you know, talking about that discoverability, because, you know, as you're talking, I'm, you know, most of us would say that Amazon's discoverability engine, its algorithm, its recommendations are the best out there right now. I mean, nothing else seems to come close to that. Do you see a point where someone's going to get this right? Like somebody's going to invent something that betters that?
Well, I my feeling on that is that I think there's a big problem in the ebook world, which is how self-contained each platform is, and that's causing blockages on ways to improve other parts of the ebook reading or the ebook ecosystem. So I think that I think there's a lot to be done, not just on discoverability, but the way that readers interact with books, maybe not while they're reading. I think, you know, all the ebook platforms have done a pretty good job of, you know, if you're reading a book, certainly for novels and regular text, they do a very good job of doing what you need to do. But there's a whole lot, you know, think of people's bookshelves, think of people's, the way books sort of live in our lives. The e-world has done a very poor job of exploring that, and part of the problem is that there's no real room for anyone to innovate on that unless Amazon decides they want to do something about it. You know, I've seen, again, Kobo's done a lot more around that, but I don't think around, you know, reading stats and trying to get commenting systems and whatnot working, but I don't think they haven't cracked it, because I think it's a very difficult design challenge. So I think there's an awful lot of room for innovation, but it's very hard to see how it's going to happen with the way the systems are set up right now, where, you know, Amazon just has everything locked in very tightly. Kobo has things very locked in very tightly. And, you know, even for those of us who are able to navigate around, you know, downloading Adobe files and figuring out DRM and all that, it's such a hurdle for innovation around other parts of the reading experience beyond just sort of buying and reading. Mm. So I think that's where I see the real innovation to come. The thing about Amazon is they are a data company, really. And so the reason they have a good recommendation engine is that it's, you know, what is built into their DNA is, how do I convert this set of eyeballs into a sale? And they do that across the board on all their products. Mm. And they're better at it than anyone else. I mean, by leaps and bounds, you're right about that. So I don't see any of the existing platforms. I mean, iBooks couldn't seem to care less, as far as I can tell. I think Kobo, you know, Kobo again, they always seem to me to do the right kinds of things. But, you know, the Kobo's in a tough position trying to fight against that giant gorilla of Amazon, as everyone is.
So. And they're still a merchandise. They're still driven by merchandising. All the others are driven by merchandising, basically, which skews it, because it's not about data, and they'd rather promote an expensive book than a cheaper book.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, the it's not necessarily the book that you would want to read. It's the book that they want to sell you that they think you're most likely to buy. You know, that's the intersection. Yeah. I think, you know, to me, the most interesting startup I've seen in the space in the last couple of years was ReadMill. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But
yeah,
which got bought and shut down. Mm. So ReadMill really tried to focus on building a tool where your highlights became something useful, where what people you could actively follow specific people to see what they were reading, what they were highlighting. And I think that shows sort of the the potential future for recommendation, where it's coming from your social stream, where you're actively kind of curating in the process of reading. But again, you know, Readmill ran into the exact problem of trying to get over the hoop of DRM around Adobe eBooks was just too much for most people to adopt it. So,
Did they get bought by Dropbox? Was it Dropbox?
They got bought by Dropbox, which and again the technology itself just got shut down. So they got bought because Dropbox is interested in growing the sort of annotation part of their business for their enterprise client. So it's not as nothing.
So they
to
bought
do with
the
books.
Tech basically for.
They bought the tech site. And the team. Who had done a very good job of building a system around lots of different people annotating a central document. So
The other startup I liked was Small Demons. Did you see that? Mm-hmm.
So those, you know, those were the two great, to me, great examples of from different angles of startups trying to do really interesting things in the book space, and both of them sort of
died
by the same sword, which was basically the difficulty of trying to do any business with the giant world of traditional publishing, which is just, you know, if you talk to anyone who's involved in startups and publishing, it's, you know, we all have tales of incredible woe to tell about, you know, the wasted time we've spent trying to do any work with traditional publishing. So that's why, go ahead. I was just going to say I have such respect for Mark Coker at Smashwords, just because from the beginning, it's just been so, you know, he never tried to woo anyone in mainstream publishing, or if he did, he quickly abandoned it and has just been so focused on delivering a distribution service to independent authors and self-publishing authors. So I think he's been very smart to just focus on where there's been great desire for what he wants, whereas, again, I think a lot of us, you know, I think anyone in publishing has a romantic notion of publishing and how we can help them, and it's always a very difficult
difficult
sort of cultural clash.
I wonder, because, you know, you're Canadian, is also Wattpad, which is in Canada too. Hugh Howey,
they're still alive.
They're still alive, and two, Hugh Howey has said the other day, I heard him, you know, the next big name author will be a 15-year-old who's currently publishing on Wattpad. You know, that's how, where people will start. What do you think about Wattpad?
Yeah, I think so. Wattpad would be the third of the triumvirate of most interesting startups. I think Wattpad, Readmill, and Small Demons. Again, Wattpad, so Small Demons, dead and gone. Readmill sort of at least got bought, but gone. Wattpad, to me, you know, they've again approached the writing problem with such a native to the web approach things, which very few people in the publishing world can get their heads around. I think what, you know, the question remains to be seen whether sort of explosive continued growth on Wattpad, what that does to the balance of what traditional publishing looks like, and how, you know, again, if you look at subscription services coming in, like what is the money situation going to look like? So I read something, I don't know the name of the author, but, you know, there was a Wattpad author, there was a stat going around that her book had been read 1 billion times. So yes, that's going to be where especially younger authors are building up their sense of what it means to write and interact with other writers. Yes, I think we're going to see bestsellers coming out of that. There's no doubt. I think what's, you know, remains to be seen is what is this industry going to look like in 10 years, and is the, you know, 99 cent or $2.99 or $10.99 or $29.99 ebook or book still going to be sort of the financial mechanism, or is it going to look more like Spotify or Pandora or whatever for books? So there's and on top of all that, you know, we've seen a leveling off of ebooks, so print remains a very important part of the business still. What's that going to look like in 10 years? How are 15-year-olds going to adapt to these things? I think there's so many difficult questions around that. But yes, I absolutely think that, you know, if you're a writer, you should be exploring Wattpad to see to what degree that can be part of your marketing strategy. Mm-hmm. And like with anything you know, the problem is you don't just set up an account and then
yeah.
watch the eyeballs roll in. Like, everything takes time, so you have to figure out what are the things that are most valuable to you.
Yeah, definitely. And now you have Pressbooks, you know, which is an ebook formatting and publishing platform. So tell us a bit more about Pressbooks.
So, yeah, the notion of Pressbooks has always been that print is going to remain important. So we took a look at the sort of problem of the production problem in the middle of creating books and tried to make a very simple system so that you could go from your manuscript to an output of ebooks, but also typeset PDFs that are ready to go to print on demand in particular. And that's what most of our users use it for. It's built on top of WordPress, so the interface is very familiar if you know anything about blogging in general and WordPress in particular. It's completely been revamped to output books. And that's really it. We make, we've got about 50 free templates, so you can choose the look and feel of your book, and those that design is reflected from the ebook to the print book as well. Mm. And I guess in terms of users, we have there's sort of, three separate kinds of businesses. We have just self-published authors who are doing, one to 10 books or whatever. We have a lot of small presses who use Pressbooks. And then we also work with some academic presses. It's mainly academic presses who are kind of the commercial users, where ranging from they're using Pressbooks to run their whole production output to paying us to basically serve as a conversion house for them. So we're doing the work for them of setting the books up and outputting them, etc. Mm. So it's, I think in the long run, the independent small publishing, self-publishing world is a lot more attractive because I think it's just going to grow. And the idea has been to make a tool that without knowing any coding, you don't have to know how to be an ebook developer, you don't have to know about InDesign and book formatting, and you can get all the files you need, the ebook, EPUB, Mobi file, and typeset PDF that's ready to go to print on demand out the other end. So that's Pressbooks.
Yeah, very handy tool. And as you say, if people do use WordPress, which lots of people do, it's kind of easier to use than other tools. So that's fantastic. And it's interesting that you talk there about the print output. So, I mean, I do print, but, only print on demand. I think the stats are now that more print books are bought online than in bookstores, right? So do you see print, print in physical bookstores as being sustainable in the current way of doing things, the wastage and all that type of thing? It seems crazy.
So what's going to happen is that more print sales are going to move online. More big bookshops are going to shut down. We're already seeing that in spades. So that's really the big, I think that's going to be the big forcing issue in traditional publishing. If you look at traditional publishing, 80% of sales in trade publishing is still print. A lot of that is driven by the marketing, you could call the placements of books in big bookstores, but those are shutting down. And I haven't seen the latest numbers on it, but I don't think it looks rosy. You'll end up starting to see a little bit more space for the smaller indie bookshops growing up again, which we're already seeing in my city, which is not a huge English language book market. I think it looks to me like, print on demand is growing faster than ebook adoption. And what's happening is people are shifting to online print sales, and I think that is going to remain at least for the foreseeable future, the next 5-10 years anyway. I think I see that being very important. But what becomes more difficult is when the venues for selling print, physical venues for selling print, start collapsing down, then again it means that the skill of finding how to market to your audience through online mechanisms is going to remain the critical skill for a publisher of any kind, small or large.
Absolutely. And you mentioned ebook pricing there a bit. We have to mention the, 6 months worth of Amazon Hachette negotiations in our yearly roundup. But now it's over. And of course, we've seen Simon and Schuster, I think, signed a deal very quickly. Do you see anything changing in the US with kind of Amazon's dominance, or do you see any impact of that boring discussion?
Well, I think it highlights what's going to be the problem is we are going to see more physical bookstores shutting down, which means that publishers have a bigger part of their channel becomes Amazon. And so there's a point where I mean, it's already the case that Amazon is the dominant player, but there's a point, you know, when that physical print part of the business becomes much more Amazon than anything else, it puts everyone at a distinct disadvantage in the negotiation department. And I think the problem as I see it is that the traditional publishers, and this is where I think self-publishing and indie publishing has a much, like they just have a huge lead time on smarts that everyone's been developing, is figuring out how to do online marketing properly. And I think that traditional bookstores still basically count on, traditional book publishers still count on its merchandising and selling through bookstores is what they do. And so the bookstores are the ones who kind of know how to move a hardcover to sell lots of units of it. And for big publishers to adjust to a world when they actually have to really truly figure out online marketing and as a fundamental part of their business, direct to consumer, I mean, that's a very hard business. You have to spend all your time figuring out how to get more eyeballs to press buy on your own site, and Amazon has a long lead on that. So I think the temporary, there's a truce, but I think if there's any big publisher who didn't see the writing on the wall there, they're crazy. So the more Amazon owns the business, the harder people are going to have to work to find other ways than the Amazon algorithm to sell lots of books.
Yeah, and I mean, that whole thing is why I don't like exclusivity, because if you let Amazon own 80% or more of your business, 100% of your business, and then they change the rules, you're screwed. So I was laid off in 2008, like many people on the GFC, and then it's like your one income stream has just disappeared. So
yeah, right.
It just seems and crazy.
I think you mitigate that by having a really strong approach to marketing your own writing. But you're in a much better position if you've got, an email list of 100,000 people and 25% of them buy every book that comes out. If you tell them, please go buy at not Amazon, then you're in a position that gives yourself a better chance to manage that difficulty. But having one channel and again counting on the algorithm of Amazon, which is what drives an awful lot of sales, that's a pretty
precarious
position for people to be in.
Yeah, and then just on the marketing, I mean, pretty much in my kind of group of indie authors, the most important thing that we focus on is building an email list. We know that Facebook is pointless, Twitter's pointless, because you don't own those platforms. And actually, when you come down to it, the only thing you do own is a list and that permission. Do you see any other form of marketing to be worthwhile? Obviously everything is lead gen, but the ultimate aim is to get an email list.
I think email list is the number one most powerful thing. That's people who are interested in what you have to say on a much, the ones who open your emails on a much larger basis than a Twitter friend or whatever. I mean, those are really ephemeral connections, whereas email list is a very explicit, relationship that you have with someone who says, yes, I'm interested when you have something new to tell me, tell me what it is. So I think, I think that's the most powerful thing. And I don't think we've seen anything yet that's better. I think that the, I think that something like Readmill and Goodreads probably to a certain extent as well, actually, no, Goodreads as well, builds up that sense of sort of marketing that happens because people in your network like something and that gets marketed. But that's, I think, from an author perspective, you need to be engaged with those kind of platforms. Goodreads is a great platform for marketing as well, but you still don't own the relationships there. And that's more reader to reader than it is author to reader. I mean, there's a certain amount of author to reader as well. But at the end of the day, the thing that you can control is an email. And that really, I think, is the most important tool out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just on global expansion, because this is something I'm very excited about. Through Kobo now, I'm selling in 61 countries, which is just thrilling. And we're seeing the growth of iBooks outside the US. And Amazon dominates in the US pretty much, and in the UK really. But like Canada, Kobo is a big seller. And I mean, maybe the next big thing will come out of China or, you know, in the Arabic language or Korean. What do you see as the kind of exciting things in global, coming up?
Yeah, I think, I guess generally what's really fascinating to think about is places like Africa that are jumping over not only, you know, telephone lines to cell phones, but skipping over computers and laptops to smartphones. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that sort of just generically, regardless of the ebook situation, that is a very interesting kind of space. But I think again, you know, that the answer, the general point is the same point as the exclusivity, that if we start thinking of global markets, it just opens up the possibility of lots more things happening in ways that might surprise you. So I think there's always a balance between the amount of time and resources you can invest in something like that, but just being very aware to being open to all channels, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the jump again that North American British English language writers generally have is that they've been thinking about this ebook and how to market their books in a way that in a place where, you know, let's say France or Germany, where there's maybe 2% of the market is digital, that there's a huge chunk of possibility there, and you know, the skills that we've been developing are perhaps further advanced than in other countries. So there's something interesting there as well. Mm. I don't know quite, you know, exactly what exploiting that or making that work for you looks like, but you know, I think what's I'm in a in Quebec, which is a French language market largely, and the digital penetration here is tiny. But what that means is that the you know, publishers who are smart about it, self-publishers or whatever, can get a real toehold in a way. You know, it's like the early days of ebooks. The smart people were kind of dominated, you know, before the big players came in and can establish themselves. So I think that's an important thing to consider.
Yeah, me too. And like, it drives me nuts when I hear all these things out of America, particularly like, oh, it's all slowing down, it's all over. And it's like the rest of the world has hardly even started yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's crazy. Think about Brazil. I've got Portuguese coming out next year, which I'm really excited about, you know. And the English-speaking people in Nigeria, for example, a big middle class with money. And I actually think that this is, you know, indies have an advantage because our pricing is lower. So, and we have global rights, so people will more likely buy our books in those other markets.
Yeah, you know, I think when you're looking at translation, then that becomes really interesting. Brazil, for sure, a huge market. And again, you just think, you know, if you've got a backlist of 10 or 20 books, and, you know, I don't know to what degree genre X or type of book X translates, you know, into demand in other kinds of cultures. But my guess is, you know, a good book translates into demand everywhere, especially if no one else is doing it. You know, if there's a sort of not very robust Brazilian market of writers or publishers putting books into the ebook marketplace, and you've got a translation of your books, then for sure you've got a chance to build in that marketplace. So yeah, definitely, you know, once translation comes into the equation, very interesting. But again, it, you know, becomes a cost of, a question of cost and resources.
Do you have China? Do you have clients in it's press books all over the world? People using it all over the world.
Yeah, we've got German, Brazilian, Chinese, lots of Hindi writers. So we have users. And
so you
and
have multiple language ability.
Yeah. Right. So Pressbooks is translated into, I think it's in, the interface is translated into 15 different languages or something. And the tricky part, this is tech land for... ebooks, but the tricky part is making sure you have fonts that support different character sets. So, for instance, we had a lot of Hindi users who were asking to use Pressbooks, and they needed the Tamil. I guess it was the Tamil script they needed. So,
Which is quite curly, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really pretty.
It's a beautiful, beautiful language. But so anyway, we built a theme that had specific font support for them, and it's a fairly active user base. So for us, Pressbooks is, I think anything you're doing in the world now, if you're not thinking what's the global potential, I mean, the focus always has to be in your, whatever your prime market is, which is usually,
America.
UK and the US. Yeah. But you get a toehold in Brazil and all of a sudden it's a whole different world. So yeah, definitely.
Good. And so I guess this ties in, but another big thing this year has been authorearnings.com, which has kind of, aiming to sort of blow the data open for authors.
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
I think it's very good to start, it's such an opaque business across the board anyway. So it's nice to start seeing some data. I know that, I'm on an email listserv that's about sort of future of publishing, and there was a very funny comment from someone who looked at the Hugh Howey's methodology and said, based on that methodology, I should have sold $20,500 worth of books, which overestimates my earnings by about $20,000. So I think, one has to take that data, which is a very, the methodology is pretty loosey-goosey, but I think, the more data we can get about this stuff, the more important it is. I mean, it's on the pricing issue. This is the very sort of strange kind of thing, that it just doesn't seem very clear what the data is about what the best price is. And, Amazon came out in that Hachette discussion, that was the big point of difference. And the problem is that Amazon's talking about how many ebooks we're going to sell, whereas Hachette is going to be looking at what's the overall picture for the book or the business, and that might be very different. But anyway, the more data we see, the better. And it's certainly, talking to people I know at Kobo and Amazon, what we are seeing is in certain categories, especially, just a total transformation of the business, and romance being kind of the one that's out front of everything else, where where the power that the self and micro publishers have is starting to basically take over the scale of the business. So
yeah, and we've seen that Laura's Cave trouble, I presume because their market share has been taken by indies. We don't know that, but one
that's
right.
That was my assumption as well. It's just a supply and demand problem.
Yeah.
I guess I had read other various explanations, but the fundamental reality that anyone lives in is supply is increasing, and so that's going to hurt everyone's, or at least that's going to hurt anyone's existing business unless they figure out how to become the next thing.
Well, it's funny because I, looking at the romance guys, women mainly, they, partially the genre lends itself to digital, but equally they were years ahead of everyone else in digital. So I'm hoping, because I write in thriller and supernatural thriller, you know, is I'm hoping that it's just that the rest of us are behind because of the number of years, you know.
Absolutely. I have no doubt that romance is the canary.
Yeah.
And that, you know, those kinds of numbers where you're looking at sort of 50% of, or, you know, close to 50% of the product being sold is self-published now, I believe, in romance. That you know, there's no reason why that's not going to happen in other other, especially genre writing. I think that the heavy nonfiction is going to be dominated by people who can pay for it better.
Yeah.
I think especially in the genre writing, it's going to go that way.
Yeah, and then kind of looking forward, because, you know, you mentioned the Futurist Manifesto that you wrote, and indeed looking at my genre, the big sellers are mainly men in their mid-60s, so I figure I've got a few years to play catch up.
Yeah, right.
But what do you see as, I mean, the things we've talked about here, I don't really consider to be that new anymore, you know, but you do have the bleeding edge of publishing in your subtitle. I wonder what do you consider the bleeding edge in 2015 and beyond, and how can we prepare?
I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier, is the problem is that the bleeding edge is very well cauterized by the way the business is structured right now. So the fact that, you know, Amazon owns Reader, book content, reading, payment
writing
mechanism, and writing, and everything's closed up in a DRM system, means that it's very hard for innovation to kind of seep into that network, which was done absolutely on purpose by Amazon. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that the big publishers sort of handed that dominance to Amazon in part. I don't want to get into it's always dangerous to get into DRM discussions, but the point is that the kinds of innovations that I would like to see, which is, you know, in the vein of what Readmill was doing, where looking at the other things that we do with books besides just reading them, I think there's a huge opportunity there for much more interesting ways of thinking about interacting with books, annotations, the social connections between like-minded readers of books. These are all very interesting design problems that have been stifled, I think, by the state of the ebook world. But I think you're right. You know, it's exactly that, the fact that the bleeding edge of the publishing isn't bleeding anymore. I mean, you know, all these things that were sort of on the cusp of happening are here and well established. What I've been surprised that I haven't seen more publishers emerge who are really good at figuring out what publishing looks like outside of the Amazon ecosystem. I think that's what I would wait to see. And I think the, you know, Wattpad gives it a hint, but I think that's very hard for an individual to do, certainly. So I think, you know, I think just it's keep eyes open and mind open and, you know, keep doing what works now, but there's still a huge amount of change that's going to happen in at some point, but it's hard to say when things get shaken loose from their existing structures, which are very rigid and are working, you know, working more or less for the major players. The readers are relatively happy. Writers are relatively happy. And, you know, I think the bigger publishers are adjusting, you know, relatively well. I'm sure everyone complains about things, but so I think that the, you know, the big transition phase one has happened, and it's hard to see how phase two, whatever that is, kind of breaks out of phase one at the moment.
Well, I think, you know, phase two, like for me and for others, it is turning into a small press. It's like, okay, now I've got loads of ebooks. Now I'm going to do print. Now I'm going to do audio. Now I'm going to do translation. Now I'm going to be more professional. Now I'm going to hire some more people. You actually think that that's what's happening? Professional self-publishers, you know, big Bella Andre and Barbara Freethy, you know, running company running micro presses now. So that, so then you think, so there, like you say, there has to be something else to break the system again. It's fascinating.
If what happens is everyone turns into exactly what was there before, except a little bit better at it. I mean, that's if you look at for instance, the world of blogging, you know, that you look back 5 or 10 years, people were reading blogs all the time. And then all of a sudden what happened was that got professionalized and you had, you know, the BuzzFeeds of the world and the Vox or the New Yorker gets good at it. And so, you know, that's what's going to happen is if Bella Andre is the best at figuring out how to market a certain category of books, then she's going to become a publisher and Random House is going to buy her at some point, you know, and so if she wants to be bought. But, you know, that as long as the structure stays as it is, I think the people who are good at the marketing of books are going to be, you know, the winners, and there's still a lot to be done to figure out how to do that really well, I think.
But overall, pretty positive, I think, for creators.
Yeah, I think you know, any time that it becomes easy to create, which is what's happened, great things happen because more people are creating, and that puts all sorts of pressure on the existing structures, which makes the economic situation of creating change. But to me, you know, that's been my principle with LibriVox, with Pressbooks, is if more people are creating, then it's just going to be a better universe. I mean, better for everyone to be creating and no one making any money than everyone just reading other people's stuff, you know?
Yeah.
The worst thing that happens is you created something that you love, then, you know, that's a good thing.
Brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. So where can people find you and Pressbooks and all your things online?
I guess pressbooks.com is where I spend most of my time, so I'm there. LibriVox.org is where you can find free public domain audiobooks. I would encourage people who are considering, especially if you're doing ebooks only and you're thinking that print might be a good idea, to check out Pressbooks. That would be my great hope for your watchers and listeners.
Oh, thank you so much for your time, Hugh. That was great.
Okay, well, thank you, Joanna.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.